Welcome to the Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays read by Leighton Pugh.
Clashing histories and present-day tensions in East Asia. Rana Mitter. On the 3rd of September 2015, a major military parade was held in Beijing, centered on Tiananmen Square. Thousands of troops paraded past, accompanied by tanks, missiles, and a flypast by fighter aircraft. The occasion for the parade was the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War in Asia, as China sought to remind the world of its role in winning the war for the Allied side. That world's leaders were impressed or shocked, depending on the viewpoint of the observers. It was notable, however, that few of them actually attended the parade in China's capital. Aside from Presidents Putin of Russia and Park of South Korea, there was little first-tier presence from the other former Allied nations or victims of Japanese wartime aggression. The US sent its ambassador, the UK its former finance minister. While many countries were happy to acknowledge China's contribution to the wartime victory to a greater extent than they had done in previous decades, there was nonetheless an uneasiness about seeming to endorse a growing Chinese military strength in the region. As China ramps up its spending and seems keen to exercise greater hegemony in Asia, it is clear that the government in Beijing will continue to lay greater stress on China's record during the Second World War and to extrapolate from it increasingly urgent demands in the geopolitics of the present day. The absence of major Western leaders, or indeed the Japanese premier, from the event showed the continuing disparity between Asian and European views of the war. As it came to an end, Western Europe worked together to write the history of the recent past. Most importantly, the key belligerents, Britain, France, and Germany, developed, under American sponsorship, a broadly equivalent post-war history of fascism faced and overcome. The fall of the communist bloc in 1989 removed the most obvious alternative narrative of the Second World War from the continent. Broadly speaking, today the North Atlantic speaks with one voice on the meaning of the war, even if the voice has different emphases in different parts of the continent. No such consensus has ever formed in Northeast Asia. As a consequence, China and Japan maintain clashing interpretations of their Second World War experience. Japan's is better known, involving the revisionist view of Tokyo's imperial wars in Asia in the 1930s and 1940s. China's revisionist take is newer, the promotion of China as a country that played a highly significant international role in the ultimate defeat of the Japanese Empire in 1945, and that now deserves to reap the benefits of its sacrifices. The Japanese revisionist view is only shared by one conservative section of the Japanese public, although that grouping receives a certain level of sympathy from more conservative circles in politics. It is almost entirely domestically directed and is vigorously opposed by liberal elements within Japan itself. There is no significant external constituency that supports the idea that Japan's aggression in Asia prior to 1945 should be reassessed in overall positive terms. The Chinese case is more complex and has been changing faster. There is a significant domestic audience for the idea that China should be given more credit for its contribution to the defeat of Japan in 1945, and that this acknowledgement of China's wartime sacrifice should help bolster contemporary ideas of Chinese identity. Unlike the revisionist Japanese discourse, the Chinese rediscovery of their wartime history is intended to have an internationalist element. However, it shares a problematic element with the Japanese discourse. It is based on political rather than historical assumptions. The behavior of the Japanese right displays a singular lack either of good taste or historical accuracy, arguing that a war of aggression was in fact a war of anti-imperialist liberation. The Chinese desire to recast their wartime contribution in the eyes of the world is much more historically accurate, largely because it makes some attempt to restore the reputation of the Chinese nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek. Without the deaths of some 14 million Chinese and the efforts of mostly nationalist armies to hold down some 750,000 or more Japanese troops, the history of East Asia might have been very different. But it is only in recent years that the nationalist contribution has been given due credit on the Chinese mainland. The rehabilitation of the nationalists is not a product of a desire for historical accuracy, however. The current Chinese regime is keen to take the more positive elements of nationalist resistance to Japan, previously rarely mentioned, during the war, and draw on it for current geopolitical needs. Most of the Western world paid little attention to the 70th anniversary of the Cairo Conference, which fell in November 2013, but in China and Taiwan, it was noted with interest. The 1943 Cairo Conference was the only Congress of the Second World War where China was treated as an equal allied power with the US and Britain, not the USSR, which was neutral in the war against Japan. For decades, this was not mentioned in Chinese textbooks because of the unfortunate historical reality that the Chinese leader who represented China at Cairo was not Mao Zedong, but Chiang Kai-shek. But the new grudging tolerance of Chiang in the mainland means that it is now possible to use Cairo to demonstrate a wider point, that China was on the side of the Allies at the most crucial moment for civilization in the last century. However, it is also clear that the meaning of Cairo is being heavily oriented toward contemporary Chinese views of the Asia-Pacific settlement. The Cairo Declaration states, "It is their purpose that Japan shall be stripped of all the islands in the Pacific which she has seized or occupied since the beginning of the First World War in 1914, and that all the territories Japan has stolen from the Chinese, such as Manchuria, Formosa, and the Pescadores, shall be restored to the Republic of China." It also added a statement that Japan should be expelled from all other territories which she has taken by violence and greed. Chinese news media reported extensively that this formulation gave the authority of international law to Chinese claims over the Diaoyu Senkaku Islands. However, this is an interpretation that has been subjected to serious questioning. The first part of the Cairo Declaration does not name the Diaoyu Islands explicitly, and since they were designated as Japanese in 1895, they do not fall under the "since 1914" clause. Therefore, the Chinese claim becomes part of the "violence and greed" clause, but as the islands are uninhabited, it is not clear against whom the charge of violence is to be thrown. To add to the complexity, the Ma Ying-jeou administration on Taiwan has made it clear that it supports the idea that the islands should return to Chinese sovereignty. But since the Cairo Declaration explicitly demands that the territory should return to the Republic of China, this opens up a new area of confusion in which the Taipei government, not Beijing, might be considered the rightful inheritor of the Chiang regime on the mainland. In addition, in Taiwan there has been lively debate over the validity of the Cairo Declaration as a legal document, as opposed to a statement of intent. Taiwan's public sphere is much freer than China's, and there have been significant voices that have doubted President Ma's reading of sovereignty over the islands. The eruption of this dispute in the present era shows how the freezing of the Cold War in post-war Asia prevented the creation of multilateral organizations and treaties that might have created a stable framework in the region. China notes correctly, that the 1952 San Francisco Treaty, which was supposed to mark the final settlement of the war in Asia, excluded the People's Republic. But the reasons for this exclusion attract blame to both actors in the dispute. The United States refused to recognize Mao's regime, excluding an emergent power from helping define an overall settlement in the region. And China, with Stalin's support, backed up North Korea in its attack on South Korea, making a settlement with the United States close to impossible. Chiang Kai-shek would no doubt have found it ironic that the current government in Beijing wishes to use his presence at Cairo as a tool to make claims for the People's Republic of China in Asia today. Still, the use of this technique shows both the flexibility and the limitations of current Chinese foreign policy making. To use the historical successes of Chiang, the old enemy, shows an ideological flexibility of some brilliance. And there is no doubt that China's contribution to the ultimate defeat of Japan in the form of both nationalist and communist resistance, which was acknowledged by Chiang's presence in Cairo, was real, substantial, and has been underappreciated in the West. However, the use of the declaration as the basis for a semi-legal argument about rights over former Japanese territories shows that China's policymakers still have a rather crude view of how to assert their case in international society. China has tried to suggest that Japan is seeking to revive its militarist past and refuses to apologize for its record. The unfortunate record of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in visiting the Yasukuni Shrine and sounding at times ambivalent over Japan's past doesn't help the Japanese case. But stressing this more concerning side of the modern Japanese psyche should not distract from the key issue, that China should be drawing rather different lessons from its wartime contribution and acknowledging the differences between 1945 and now. Most importantly, China is the country that has the greatest need to create a more powerful internationalist viewpoint about itself in the region. Japan has had right-wing premiers in the past and will do so again. It has also had leftists and LDP centrists. It also has a lively public sphere that does not hesitate to tell Mr. Abe where he is getting things wrong. In the last resort, even if South Korea is insulted by Abe's visit to Yasukuni, President Park has no fear that a rising Japan is going to reconquer Korea. Nor does any other actor in the region fear rising Japanese imperialism. Rather, China should learn the most important lessons of the country that did become the hegemon in Asia after 1945. Not China, but the United States. The United States tried to exercise two different types of power in the region. One involved the propagation of pluralism and civil society, as in Japan. This sometimes involved going against the US's most obvious interests. American complaints about Japanese protectionism were a constant of the Cold War. But it proved a worthwhile investment in converting Japan from a resentful imperialist aggressor to a peaceful world citizen. More slowly, similar pressures also helped to develop South Korea and Taiwan as well. The misguided side of American influence in the region was visible in the tragedy of Vietnam, where they tried to prop up a regime with little chance of surviving, essentially for their own geopolitical interests. China needs to learn the first lesson of American post-war power in Asia, not the second. The US's immense contribution to the liberation of Asia from Japanese rule earned it the right to influence in the region. But the price of that influence involved leadership that sometimes went against America's own interests. China's contribution to the defeat of Japan was also substantial, and it is right that China should be given the rewards of that contribution, even 7 decades later. But it is important to understand what those rewards are. They do not relate to the legalistic unpicking of territorial disputes. They relate to leadership, and true leadership in the region involves understanding how others view the actions and intentions of China as a major player in the region. Japan's conservatives sometimes show little understanding of how Japan's neighbors view their take on Japan's wartime history. China's leaders need to show that their understanding of their region and its history is more sensitive and more positive.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.